And none of the jokes involve you, Mr. Chairman.
The Senate Rules Committee will come together. I just think the fact that Senator knows the party planner is interesting. Senator Ress, NFL 3072.
Mr. Chairman and members, good afternoon. The Senate file 372 is a proposal for a constitutional.
Senator Ress, speak up just a little. They don't amplify, so you have to use your stage voice.
Your floor voice.
Oh, she's.
My floor voice is like this.
Stage voice.
Mr. Chairman and members, good afternoon. Senate file 3072 is a proposal for a constitutional amendment that would allow, in the amended version that is before you, the legislature by two-thirds majority in each body to call itself into special session for a limited amount of time. And the in the agreement that would be set forward to have a special session, it would indicate what the agenda was limited to, and also it would be limited to 7 days. Obviously, also, the governor of the state continues to have the authority to call a special session. Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout if members would like to, if I could have that handed out.
Mr. Chair, it's very seldom that one party has two-thirds of both houses. So in the case they don't, then the governor of another party could just say, don't vote for a special session, and there won't be one. Unless they're kind of ornery types of things.
Mr. Chairman, in the original bill and the proposal was initiated by Representative Carlson, the language read that you just needed a majority vote, which would mean that whatever, if one party was in the majority in both bodies, like ours is right now, you could do this limited special session. In the committee, the argument was made that it really should be an extraordinary event and that it would be two-thirds. Representative Carlson's bill in the House still has it as a majority, and he and I know that our versions of it at this point are different. It came to my mind, however, too, that cooperation between the parties in the legislature did occur when we had a governor who was not of either party, and we more than one occasion, the minority and the majority cooperated to override a governor's veto. And I don't mean by, the 5 votes that they got on the transportation vote and bill in the House. I think that is extremely extraordinary and probably never happened again. But we did override and work together for what we believe to be the common good in overriding a number of Governor Ventura's vetoes. Now, I certainly don't object to it being the majority, but that was the will of the committee. What I had passed out to you is information to let you know that it is not an extraordinary. You don't have it?
No.
I'm sorry. It is not extraordinary for, and I have a few extra copies too. I don't know if you need them. It is not extraordinary for a legislature to have on a limited basis, like is being proposed here, authority to call itself into special session. And as a matter of fact, it is more common for the legislature to have that authority. And you can see on this page 2179, and this is coming from the NCSL, that there are some 33 states out of the 50 that are able to do that. And then on the inside of there is the description of under what circumstances a legislature might do that, and you can see that on many occasions it is indeed 2/3 of the legislature that is able to do that, but in some states it is a majority.
Mr. Chairman, why does the title say that it would allow legislature or presiding officers to call? I don't see that. Have I missed this part about the presiding officers calling a special session?
Mr. Chairman, the engrossment that you have, I guess the title was not amended, but that was part of the original proposal, and that was also amended out in the state and local government so that it was not going to be left just to two people. And so it's 2/3 of
Senator Olson
body.
Senator Olson moves on line 1.3, just to clean this up.
Yeah.
Senator Olson moves on line 1.3 to delete or presiding officers.
Mm-hmm. That would correct the title, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion carried.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Est, I'm also kind of was surprised to see the question on 2.4, because you're adding a provision to allow the legislature to call a special session, but the question says, shall the Constitution be amended to require the legislature to meet in special session for up to 7 days upon the agreement? Kind of an interesting way of wording that question. The ballot question. Shall the Constitution be amended to allow the legislature to meet after 7 days upon the agreement? Why wouldn't you use allow instead of require?
As I understand it, once 2/3 of, in my bill here now, once 2/3 of the members had signed the petition, the legislature would be required to meet. It would no longer be permissive, they would have to meet. And I guess that's, if you didn't have it that way, then there would be some ambiguity about even when you had 2/3 of the members of both bodies signing a petition, that there would be some discretion about whether a special session was called or not. But once the condition had been met, of the 2/3 of each body petitioning, then the special session would be required. Maybe there's a more elegant way of saying it, but the intent is that once that happens, there is no discretion left about whether a special session is called.
I understand that, but it's just.
Seems a little bit strange.
Mr. Chairman, I think that Senator Rest has stated it accurately, that once the 2/3 of the members of each House sign a petition, then the legislature is required.
Well, you could get a limbo there, couldn't you? 2/3
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's what it says on the other, that if they've done upon written agreement, the legislature shall convene in special session. But we're asking the people to change the Constitution to allow another means of bringing that about. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the mood of the people out there is in terms of us doing whatever. But whether that this wording would make it easier to pass the question, or whether it would it's somewhat, it seems somewhat convoluted to me, but.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, the way this is worded, two-thirds of the legislature could call a special session, irregardless of what the legislative leaders wanted.
Exactly.
So it really leaves it with two-thirds
it's
of the members.
Power of, it's the power of the members, not of the leaders.
Senator Berglund?
You know, I tend to agree that there should be a mechanism, another mechanism to call the legislature into a special session under extraordinary circumstances, but I'm not really, I don't really believe we should waste a constitutional amendment on a legislative thing, so it'd be just such a rare situation that would ever be.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me, before you ever get to the two-thirds, the governor would call it. I can't quite see a governor not calling it if you could get two-thirds of both houses, particularly if both houses were not mm-hmm. at the two-thirds mark by one party. And I don't know how, I think it's been very, very rare. So it seems to me it should be, I can understand we want more than majority, but it seemed like 60% or something rather than. But I think this would be kind of meaningless.
Mr. Chairman, looking at the two topics that related to the legislature, it might be an interesting test of the people's satisfaction of our performance in the prior session as to whether they would want us to have any more authority of any kind, much less kind of additional compensation. But
Mr. Chairman, again, this is
especially in the, when you're go through a very challenging session.
So. Mr. Chairman and members, it would not what this proposal is doing is not putting us out of sync with what happens in a lot of states, but is putting us more in sync. And there may be. You know, extraordinary circumstance. I mean, really extraordinary circumstances that are not partisan, where the legislature would want to be called into. I mean, some incapacity on the part of the governor, the lieutenant governor, but nevertheless, the legislature would want to act. And if it, you know, it if there was some disaster or whatever, and the. And so I think if you look also on the end pages are the are the circumstances under which in other states the special sessions were called, and of course for us our special sessions, and we have had them at, almost every year. Again, are only called by the governor.
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that there would be extraordinary occasions. That wording in the Senate in the sentence or the question might be helpful, but the way the legislative language is constructed, it sounds like the governor can do that on extraordinary occasions, but it doesn't appear to me that is a requirement of the legislature, that we could call it for any reason we wanted to.
Well, yes.
That precedes the sentence that a special session of the legislature may also be called by the governor on extraordinary occasions. That terminology of extraordinary occasions is not anywhere connected to the legislature call.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, we're trying to include the legislature under that same language without having to amend anything more than allowing the legislature to, by petition of itself, to require a special session, and we didn't want to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm just suggesting that the way this is arranged or organized doesn't seem to put in statute what you have said in terms of
this is the
an extraordinary occasion. You're just saying that it would probably be an extraordinary occasion that would ever get two-thirds of both bodies to agree to do something like this. It's quite more of an assumption than a statement.
Senator Russ, don't you think Senator Langseth logic is the correct logic here? A governor will have called one by the time you get
to two-thirds.
So let me just offer, if someone wanted to actually do that, if we wanted to do something here that actually created the possibility that something different could happen here, and I throw this out, I just thought of it when we were sitting here. Mm-hmm. The original bill had the presiding officers of each body or
a majority
of the bodies. Mm-hmm. And I can see problems with both of those. So how about something like this? The rules committees of both houses with the consent of the majorities of both houses. It seems to me, here's what would happen. If the leaders wanted to come back, they would start by trying to convince the rule committee. And that would set in motion kind of a petition process in each body. Or a petition process in each body could kind of almost put some pressure on the rules committees to take it up. So you'd have a check there, too. The leaders then could maybe say, no, things are out of hand here. I'm not going to call a rules committee meeting. Unless it's such overwhelming, they'd have to. So there's a check there. But the check the other way is, even if the rules committee decided to do it, they would still have to get a majority of the bodies. Now, I think if you're in the minority, you would say, well, all right, but the majority controls both of those. But it does create a different option. Whereas I think Senator Langseth's right. I don't think this really creates a new option as it's currently drafted.
Mr. Chairman, I I'm only reflecting what happened in the committee, and I feel like I need to support the committee report. It was not my amendment.
Why don't we just try to open
but
it up
but I do think that either returning to for the purposes of discussion, returning to Representative Carlson's original bill, although I don't think it should just be in the hands of the two presiding officers, quite frankly.
That is, the President and the Speaker of the House could say, we're
yes,
coming back.
Right. I don't
that
think
is
that.
A good idea.
Yeah, yeah. But.
Well, think about, Mr. President, think about that.
So that.
I think you're.
So, Mr. Chairman, so removing, not putting back in the President or Speaker or the presiding officers, but either your approach or going back to a majority of the members of both bodies. And I'm not sure that it's always going to be the assumption that the majority members of each body, particularly if there were close majorities, like has been far more the rule than the exception, that that's a slam dunk that caucuses are going to be lockstep with regard to any particular issue that might be on the agenda.
Mr. Pro Tem, what do you think?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a question before that. We've already passed one constitutional amendment to the ballot. How many constitutional amendments are we going to have in the ballot this fall? Because I think it's the general thought and truism that if you have a lot of constitutional amendments in the ballot, none of them pass.
Senator Frederickson, I think that's an excellent question. We happen to have some history here with us.
They're in your folders.
They're in the folder.
Yeah.
Mr. Watson. Have you seen this one somewhere else?
Oh, yes.
It's exciting.
What is this?
I don't have a copy of it with me, though,
we
if I may.
Sarah, do you have one?
Members, it looks something like this. There are actually two documents, paper clipped together.
Yeah, okay.
Does everybody have it?
Yes.
Just before you get there, 1877, a constitutional amendment to authorize women to vote in local optional elections was rejected by the voters.
Look at 1865 and 1867.
1865? Yes, those are pretty appalling.
Boy.
1865,
I've gone over
abolished
that whole list.
Mahnomen County. That was, I wonder where that was. Mr. Watson, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, just to walk you through this, the first document is something from the Secretary of State's office giving a general overview of the constitutional amendment process. And of particular relevance to the question just raised is on page 4, the bottom of page 4. There's a paragraph that is circled where Betty Kane, who wrote this, says there's no discernible difference between the fate of amendments presented at presidential elections and those at which only state officials are elected, but the number of amendments on the ballot has had a bearing on the acceptance-rejection ratios. Approval percentages for 2 to 4 ballot questions are much higher than for 5 to 11, that top number being submitted in 1914. Oddly enough, of the 7 amendments submitted alone on the ballot, 6 failed. So I think that's in line with the conventional wisdom that if you put too many on, they're going to tend to fail. And that maximum number seems to be about 4. And then, as you can see from looking at the attached table, that's about what's happened. Note the difference between the results from 1858 to 1898 and the results after 1898. There's a nice little line drawing there, change in the amendment process. Before 1900, the Constitution permitted an amendment by a simple majority of those voting on the question, and you can see an awful lot of them passed. But after that, it took a majority of those voting at the election, and so the passage rates were not nearly as high. On page...
If you would switch pages?
Yep.
Senator Olson, 1898. Permit women to vote for and serve on library board. That passed. 1898.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, didn't women get to be on school boards before that, though, I believe?
Yeah, sure, we'd have to vote for it.
Mr. Chairman, it must have been the foot in the door.
Yes. What a slippery slope.
Mr. Watson.
I think you're right about the... let's see. Women got to vote... No. No, 1877, authorized women to vote in local optional. That
the
I
late,
was rejected.
Later,
but somewhere there.
Later in that. It was like the 80s.
1898.
Before then.
Women to vote for and serve on library boards.
No.
School boards. But I gave my copy.
Oh, here it is. 1875 on page 8. To authorize the legislature to grant women suffrage in school affairs was adopted. 1875.
Did they ever, did they do it?
Mm-hmm. Accepted. Yes.
It was accepted.
Adopted.
Mr. No, no, Mr. Chairman, did the legislature grant it?
Oh, oh.
Probably not.
Oh, good question.
That's the thing.
Chairman,
I'm
that
about.
Actually, women voting in school elections was very common across the United States in many jurisdictions, and I think the first ones were in southern states, as a matter of fact. Women could vote in school elections in Virginia, where I was born, very early on.
Mr. Watson, you're up to page.
Oh, on the bottom page 60, you see that the 1914 election, the legislature had a success rate of 1 for 11. And then 2 for 8 in 1916, and 2 for 5 in 1924. 1 for 5 in 1934, 0 for 4 in 48, 0
was there,
for 5.
Was there ever 2 for 2?
Yeah, 2 for 2 in
I'm only proposing one here. I'm not proposing another half a dozen.
Well, the later years, if you work backwards, 1 for 1, 3 for 3, 2 for 2, 0 for 1, 1 for 1, 3 for 3, 2 for 2, 4 for 4. But going back to 1980, the success rate's been very good. Off-track betting did not. Senator Metzen, off-track wagering didn't make it.
Yeah, I see that.
See, the 1980 one was the one that, Mr. Chairman, that fascinated me. It was the 1 for 5. The only one that passed was to require campaign spending limits for all state candidates, you know, allowing the legislature. That was the only one that passed, and they came back and doubled the amount. I don't think that's what the people thought they were voting for. that would be the only one that passed.
So, Senator Frederickson, I think this gives us some insight on the question you raised. Looks like somewhere between 2 and 4 is a good number.
Or, Mr. Chairman, between 2 and 4 does not harm the possibility of any one of the 2 to 4 passing. It's when it gets to be a number beyond that, regardless of the merits of the proposal, the chances are lessened.
One by itself is a little less than 50% here, it looks like.
So having a second one would be helpful.
Apparently. Maybe more interest, more people.
I don't know.
There's 2 campaigns for them, and
right.
People pay more.
Who knows?
Theoretically, no. Other questions? Back to the bigger picture, Senator Metzen. I'm sorry, Senator Senjan.
I like the Wyoming plan.
Senator Metzen, Wyoming. What's Wyoming do?
Well, it gives me something to say.
It's on the last page. What it does is, and your suggestion, Mr. Chairman, was to have the Rules Committee be instructed in a sense by the body. And what the Wyoming plan is to compel the presiding officers to call a special session upon petition of the two-thirds of the members. All right, is it two-thirds or a majority of the members?
I think it's a majority of the members. If you have 60.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't we lay this one over and let members think about it a little bit? There's a lot of information here.
Mr. Chair, could I just maybe follow up with a question? I don't know. You know, the Constitution to me is a fairly sacred document, albeit there's been many, many amendments, but... maybe it's not as sacred as I think it is. But what's the compelling reason to do this? I'm just trying to think of my history. When would we call a special session that perhaps wouldn't have been called anyway? You know, maybe we didn't want to be in the Civil War. I don't know. But you know, what is that great big compelling reason that would suggest that this is an important thing to do?
I really can't think of
it. Mr. Chairman, I think it is, as is the experience in other states, it is indeed a balance of power issue, and it is making assertions that the legislature should have more authority to balance that of the singular authority of the governor in regard to this particular thing. And it's not, again, it's not considered an extraordinary attribute of legislatures, because some 33 legislatures do have either outright authority or limited authority to call themselves into special session. And I think it is a check and balance, and it is asserting authority of the legislature in this regard. And you may find that in your own mind that the legislature should not have that increased authority or power, and that you'd rather have it in the hands solely of the governor. That's not the common experience of other states.
Thank you. Chairman, is there any track record? Oh, is this the last one? Is that saying how many? That's a summary of how many times we've had legislative special sessions have been called. What these last 2 pages are.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, that is correct. And I believe
like Nevada has.
It is.
1989 was the last time one had been called, but the legislature can't call it.
This information is from the NCSL, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, but goes through the year 2000, and I don't know whether NCSL, through the legislative secretaries and clerks, have updated this information. But we thought it was instructive, at least on the number of times within that period, and the question was within 10 years, and then to ask how many times, even in those states where the legislature had limited authority, did they see the need to exercise it. But, Mr. Chairman, I'm perfectly happy to have members consider it. And if you want to lay it over, and maybe I could have at some point some amendments drafted that reflect your suggestion, rather than try and do it here on the fly, Senator Metzen's suggestion, and then maybe even circulate those informally and see what members think.
Does that make sense, members?
That would be fine with me.
Thanks, Senator Rest.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carlson. A resolution. Do you have one? What's your time?
Sometime.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, what I have is I have Senate file 1948, and you have House file 995 in your possession. And what we want to do is substitute House file 995.
So that's the language you would like to work with?
Yes, we would like to work with that. And what this is, committee members, is there's a major storm brewing, and there's a lot of indicators that this storm is coming. A lot of people are recognizing that we have to have the vision to look forward and see into that storm and see what it's going to do to us. And the nature of it is called peak oil. Peak oil is the term assigned to an interval of time when, despite all efforts to search for, to drill for, and to capitalize for more crude oil, the additional new production cannot keep up with new demand and fall off in production. And members, you always have to keep those three things in mind. We're finding new oil, but the rate at which we're finding new oil is dropping off. We're still drilling a lot of oil, but the drilling of oil is dropping off. Wells go dry. Wells stop the old gusher type is just not a reality anymore. And then we're also adding more demand. And probably the biggest way I can illustrate that is that between China and India, they're adding 3,000 cars a day to the roads over there. And they're not going to go back once they start to drive. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, recommends development of a strategy to address the peak and decline in oil production be done. And the GAO did do this, and they found some results that they found that oil production will peak sometime between now and 2040. And it's not going to be a sharp peak. It's going to be a dull peak. And I guess I look back at when I ride a bicycle on a mountain, there's something called false peaks. And that's when you think you've reached the summit, but then suddenly it goes down a little bit, and then it goes back up again. This is going to be a dull peak. We'll find new technologies. We'll find new reserves. We'll find new places to get oil, and it'll look like we haven't reached the peak, but we will be reaching this peak. Minnesota doesn't have any oil. We get all of our oil from other places in the country and outside of the country. Our major source right now for at least two or three of our refineries is Canada. And we have pipelines that bring it right to our refineries. We're adding another pipeline soon, and that's going to go into Flint Hills Resources. And even there, with the Canadian oil is very expensive to recover. Give you just another little education portion of this. There's something called the EROEI, and embedded in there is return on investment. But the two E's are for energy returned on energy invested. And what happened back in years ago in Pennsylvania when oil was discovered, it was laying on the ground. You could scrape it up. After that, there were gushers. It was probably one unit of energy would get you 100 units back. So one barrel of energy would get you 100 barrels back. In the 1930s in Texas, that's the way it was. By 1970, a lot of the oil wells were starting to go dry. There was a lot more research and a lot more discoveries, but the average was dropping down to 30 to 1. In other words, one barrel of oil would get you 30 back. Today, that ratio has dropped to one barrel in gives you 15 back. And now you hear a lot about these other locations. You hear about Anwar. You hear about the Canadian tar sands. You hear about the North Dakota tar sands. The ratio for those is one barrel in gets you only three back. And what that means is that it's going to cost us a lot more. And it's going to take a lot more capital. It's going to take a lot more drilling. It's going to take a lot of pipelines. Another thing that you need to think about with that Canadian oil is that it's very thick, and it has to be heated or it has to be diluted with a diluent, they call it, to be able to pump it. And in fact, that pipeline that we're talking about is a two-way pipeline. They're going to actually pipe naphtha up to Canada to dilute that oil so that it can be pumped back down here. It also requires a lot of natural gas. Canada is diverting a lot of their natural gas to be able to bring out and recover that oil. Soon, the natural gas is going to run low in Canada, and they're going to cut us off. So we need to look at what we have to do to deal with peak oil in Minnesota, probably more than most other states. We do have a lot of demand for oil here in this state. We do have rather large refineries. Our refinery in Flint Hills, for instance, it was built in 1955. It refined about 30,000 to 40,000 barrels a day at that time. Now it's up to 280,000 barrels a day. And they're adding 50,000 barrels a day more capacity to it. We've added more capacity to other of our refineries also. The production is not a problem, but getting the crude is going to be a problem. And that's the nature of peak oil.
Why don't you kind of get to the thick of it, what we're doing?
Okay, what I would like you to do is I would like you to allow this resolution to be taken up on the floor and discussed and look at all of the elements of it and come up with a vote that demonstrates that we are looking at confronting the challenges of peak oil.
Senator Cohen, Senator Carlson, if I could make a suggestion.
Yes.
And we are working out the highest line numbers.
Yes.
I wonder if lines 219 to 222 are necessary. I think there would be a lot of discussion here about what is a global oil depletion protocol, and I'm just not sure you need that right now. I don't know if we have that much power. And so my suggestion would be to delete that paragraph. And then on lines 27 and 28, I think it might be better if we just resolve that the governor task appropriate state agencies to develop a statewide assessment or something.
Assessment, yeah. Mm-hmm.
To me, then, you've got something here that is doable, and we're basically asking the governor to do this, and we really, I presume the governor might say to us, well, I don't have the money to do that, send an appropriation, or the governor would accept it in the spirit that it's written and go, yeah, that's a pretty good idea. Why don't we start to get to work on that?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Burgum.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Carlson, do you know how many times the legislature has ever passed a resolution asking the governor to do something? asking the governor to do something by resolution.
From what I am hearing in history, this may be a first.
Mr. Chairman, America's a consent Carlson. Have you considered why that might be that we need the governor to support?
No, I haven't. Other than we're looking at something that is rather unique.
So, Senator Carlson,
help me understand.
I would like to. Senator Clark, I think, moved to delete lines 2.19 to 2.22. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. And then Senator Clark moves that on line 2.27, delete, should recommend funding and should give direction to, and insert, task, T-A-S-K, appropriate. And then on line 228, delete, for the, insert, to. And then delete for the, insert two, and then after the word development, strike the rest to the colon, semicolon, and insert statewide assessment.
Say, read what you just said.
So it would read, be it further resolved that the governor task appropriate state departments to develop. To develop, correct, to develop a statewide assessment.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the way this is organized now, this is resolving that the legislature is going to do something. It supports the undertaking of the statewide assessment in order to inventory. And then the resolve was that directing the governor to recommend funding and direction. So who's going to do what? Are we telling ourselves to do the assessment? Now, you're moving it down to that the governor should do.
I think it's support. The legislature supports the undertaking of an assessment and asks the governor to set in motion an assessment in the state agencies is the way I think it would be structured.
Mr. Chair?
So I'm the Clark motion first. On the Clark motion.
I'm wondering if we could add one more suggestion to that.
Senator Clark, maybe another suggestion.
On line 218, this is not a big deal, but I think if we could remove the word unprecedented, I just think it takes a little fire out of this thing. And
Senator Clark?
Yes, I consider it to be
friendly.
Settles
people down. And
Senator Clark includes that.
I think that word distracts from.
Yeah. So on the Clark motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Senator Berglund, it's unique.
Well, generally speaking, resolutions aren't very effective, and I would think a resolution directed at the governor would be especially ineffective. I mean,
you mean any executive? You don't mean particularly this one.
I mean, I guess my reaction is if we think this is a problem, we should have interim committees work on it or a commission work on it with the state agencies and figure out what to do. But, you know, it's.
Or, Mr. Chairman, actually meet and talk with the governor about it.
Senator Carlson, has there been some consideration given to that approach?
I believe there has, yes. I'm not privy to it, though. No.
This, as I understand it, the House.
Yes.
Initiated.
They have passed it, yes.
And I'm wondering, Senator Berglund, if maybe we pass something like we've got it that would create a conference committee and maybe they could figure something out. Or
I didn't hear what you said.
Well, it might create a conference committee and that group. If some thoughtful members were put on a conference committee, they could figure something out. Maybe. Interest. I should have said interested members. Senator Sendrum.
Chair, I don't know. I've probably been to four or five of these peak oil meetings back home as well as up here. Obviously, this resolution is a very small micro step in any solution to peak oil, but I think it does draw at least some focus to it. It's a great big worldwide issue, and I think just doing this, I think, compels in some small way a little attention to it, and I think it's probably good.
Senator Bergen, I wonder if the governor wouldn't actually kind of be interested in this. You know, he's head of the National Governors Association. This may be something he could maybe run with.
Well, of course, if the governor wants to give direction to state departments.
He doesn't need us to.
Exactly.
Senator Berglund, you're thinking maybe just walking down to the governor's office and getting an appointment and discussing it with him.
That's precisely.
Could be in the end game deal.
I mean,
Mr. Chair, another thought would be perhaps that the governor could bring to the National Governors Association, that it's not directly about our state, but the broader global issue, and at least I'd be giving him a task, you know. He could do that anyway, Senator Bergen.
I'm sure, Mr. Chairman.
Just trying to be
Senator
helpful.
Senator Clark, that the governor would appreciate us sending him a resolution telling him what to do with the National Governors Association.
I think he'd just appreciate us trying to be helpful.
Do you know, members, it may be that Senator Bergen is carrying a little baggage from other activities this session into this committee right now?
No.
You've spent all day with the governor's people, I understand it.
No, we spent a couple hours yesterday, but it doesn't affect how I feel about this. I mean, it was pretty productive meetings.
Members, what if we send this to the floor like this, and Senator Carlson will be chatting with folks and see where we're going, and then depending on how some conversations he has with the executive folks that might be interested in this go, we can take it up on the floor.
And I don't know if they've had any discussion with some of our energy people, but it wouldn't hurt before that happens that people like Rosen, Jungbauer, are, you know, the folks that
sure
are on the energy committee on our side, would maybe you could have some conversation with them about it.
Absolutely. Sure.
Okay, so Senator Clark moves that House File 995 as amended. Senator Bergen further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson, the committee was in a pretty good mood today. I think you got some ways to go there, Senator Carlson.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Clark. Thank you, Senator Carlson. Thank
Chair and members, we have in front of us the second constitutional amendment for the day. It happens to relate to legislative and executive compensation. And, Mr. Chair, there's an A-19 amendment. Does it delete everything?
Senator Clark moves the A-19, and this is to delete everything. Has this been to another committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's been to...
I should explain it first. So it's been where?
Local government.
Okay, so you better explain
state and local government.
Or before we consider it. Go ahead.
As by way of background, very quickly, as you are all more than well aware, the Constitution currently authorizes, requires the legislature to set our and the executive's own pay. And even with that being in the Constitution, there has been an ongoing challenge, both political in terms of perception, difficulty in the ability to modify the compensation. And one, some could argue there's an inherent conflict of interest. Like other types of entities that sometimes provides a challenge with recruitment and retention. So as many of you, some of you whom were here, there was a compensation council created to attempt to rectify this situation. It's been working pretty well for over 20 years with good work with regardless of who's been appointed. But there's been a challenge in that it's generally not followed. For example, there's been no change in legislative pay in the last 10 years. There has been some modification in per diem, but even doing that ended up flagging perhaps the perception issue once again about what was happening. And because of this inherent problem, a number of people have been talking, and what this is attempting to do is take a step back and remove ourselves fully from the conflict and the perception and allow the council, the compensation council, to do its work, and their recommendations would go into place. I think kind of as Senator Langthorne, I think I'm paraphrasing you, we want to have compensation at a level that people can actually do this job, but not so high that people want to run for office because of the pay. So there's also been an ongoing challenge with particularly the governor, but with our constitutional officers. We have to vote on pay. The governor has to sign. And that has been the primary challenges here. Judges have been in a slightly different situation. Judges have, certainly this last year, came and lobbied us both about the needs of the courts as well as their compensation, and so that has provided a challenge. So in local government, what we had done there was to tie the compensation council, trying to go ahead and use what's already in process to be the entity at which would be determining our salaries, determining salaries in each of the three branches. After talking to a number of members, this particular amendment, and I know that there's at least one person here really sad to hear this, removes judges from the constitutional piece. But that is what was trying to do coming into this. What this amendment does a little bit differently is trying to clean up some language, working with members on both sides of the aisle in terms of the question. And because we would be building off of the current compensation council, there frankly was words in the last version of this were not needed. So, and Mr. Watson, I don't know if there's anything else you would want to add that I might have missed on this.
So the key difference from the bill as it comes from the other committee is judges.
Yes.
Members want to discuss that?
I'm not being critical. We just get these, and you just try to consume it real quickly. Can you just kind of tell us what this says in two or three sentences?
Sure. I think the first thing you should look at is on page 2, lines 2.3 and 2.4. The question in front of voters would be, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to transfer from the legislature to a citizens' council the authority to set salaries for legislators and executive officers? Currently, Senator Senjum, we do have the compensation council that you can see in Article 2 under the statutory changes. And again, it's been working pretty well. Another change, though,
who's on it
is a combination of there's appointments made from the governor, one in each congressional district. There are two that are made.
Look in the report from Senator Rest Committee.
Yes.
The second page lists who's on the current council.
Apparently, who is on it? Two appointments from.
The membership is right here. Okay. Yeah. Oh, it's laid out a little simpler.
Right. There are appointments from all three branches. A key difference is that currently legislators actually sit on or can sit on the council. We wanted to remove that, so legislators would not be sitting on it. And if you look at lines 2.18 and 2.19, it It modifies the Compensation Council just minimally. It still consists of the 16 members. The appointments would still be the same. But who must be residents of this state, and no more than four of whom may have held any elective office under the Minnesota Constitution. And that was one of Senator Fredrickson and Wergen's ideas in terms of it may make some sense to have had either some former legislators or former people who had been elected in some way, but not currently because of that conflict.
Mr. Chairman?
Clark, office elective under the Minnesota Constitution, does that leave out all the local? Are locals under
locals
the Constitution?
Locals could, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, locals could be appointed, so the governor could say the mayor of such and so could
do
be appointed.
Under the four is what I'm talking about. Are they under the definition of those elective under the Minnesota Constitution, or is that only no. legislature and the constitutional officers?
Legislature, constitutional officers, judiciary.
We have statutes for the
correct,
local, but not constitution.
That's right.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, in addition to that, it would be judges. Legislators, constitutional
and judges.
Officers,
and judges
are all elected under the Constitution.
Okay, judges would count in that four, too, then.
Yeah.
And again, members, the idea is that this would be a citizen group. You know, again, trying to remove that perception barrier, but recognizing also, as certainly Senator Fredericks and I have had some conversations, that maybe having at least a few people on there who have some experience or background.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be important to have four members of a 16-member council who have served in these offices and have a better feel for what's involved. I think they'd be a good insight for the council. Still be very much a minority, only four of 16.
And Mr. Chair, members, this is no more than previously, not current.
Previously.
And it's a may, not a shall.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, are you suggesting that it should be a shall, that there should be four on there, or that is may adequate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think may is adequate. My preference would be that there would be four with three in office. Mm-hmm.
So, Senator Clark moves the 19 discussion. All in favor, Senator Sandin?
I'm just reading the first line, or at least one line 1-9. Just talks about base salary. Does any of this? I guess we don't know, but is it assumed that per diem would continue at this point or not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sandin, after a great deal of conversation with a number of people. What base salary would mean is specifically that is salary, and items like travel, I'm going blank,
telephone.
I was actually thinking about our
housing.
I can't say the word housing. For those of us who live in greater Minnesota, those kinds of expenses would be, right, they would be determined by law, as would things like our insurance and our retirement. That's done under the negotiated. There's also, you may recall, we happen to have three leadership differentials that would continue under current law. My understanding, and Mr. Hubinger may want to come up and talk if you want him to, is that the council does look at in its recommendations broadly what are the kind of other compensation or expenses that are covered when they're making their recommendations. I believe it is critically important that the council would continue to look at those things because that is part of when you look at on page 3 under criteria, subdivision 4 on lines 3.20 on. It does also talk about, in looking at the recommended compensation, the council shall also consider the average length of a legislative session, the amount of work required in interim periods, the opportunities to earn income from other sources without neglecting duties, et cetera. Taking kind of that market basket look is an important thing. So, Senator Sandin, my belief would be that we would see the expense part dealt with in a responsible way legislatively as currently indicated under law, but that the Compensation Council would be taking a look at all of that and it would be impacting its decisions.
Mr. Chairman, this doesn't appear to change the authority, if you will, of the Rules Committee or to set per diem. That is still there. It may change the context. Am I correct? Did I hear something, or am I imagining it, that there is a lawsuit right now regarding our per diem, suggesting that it really is income? And in some respects, since it is taxes are withheld as if it is on it, there may be some legitimacy to that that charge if that's going forward. And
it's one of the reasons you're doing this, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson and Senator Metz, and that's one of the things that just, again, that perception. In talking to a number of attorneys that work in this area, they believe that the lawsuit will end up ultimately being resolved, dismissed in whatever way. But it does, again, highlight the perception issue and our inherent conflict, because when does something change from being a piece of expenses versus something else? You know, there's other legislatures that do things like looking at the entire federal reimbursement, putting mileage and the housing expenses together, the lodging, and that's what their per diem is. There are some that do a variety of different types of pieces. And so I believe that it's a political issue and the own challenge that we have. And that's where, if the compensation is determined elsewhere. I had per diem specifically in here, Senator Olson. I am not opposed at all to it being in here. But in talking to a number of people, it is a challenge to figure out how you do the balance with expense reimbursement versus something else. And that's where that compensation council can end up saying, look, this is, we see that they're getting X per diem, so we believe that will be impacted in Y salary. And certainly, Senator Olson, if you'd like to make a modification on there, I'm more than open to it. But I've talked to a number of people who are just trying to figure out, how do we do this cleanly? We looked at trying to figure out how you set a standard rate versus something else. And my guess is if there's a modification in compensation, we probably would see likewise.
Mr. Chairman, essentially how I see it is that we've had the Compensation Council, but it really hasn't had great impact because of the current process. It would be asking the people to allow that to have some authority, and
it would just go into effect, and it, right.
Yeah, and then I think Senator Clark hit on it hard enough, but in terms of that lawsuit, this is the kind of stuff that will negate that or clean that up, I think, going forward. So, mm-hmm. Not it won't pertain to the one going on, but I think we'll get out of that. But this will.
But if it didn't,
stop that going forward, I would think. Is that correct?
I think so. Or it would be, you know, I think that one way that'll impact things. And Mr. Chair, members, just real quickly, I do think everybody on this committee has obviously served far longer than I have, but legislators come here to be public servants, and people take seriously this job. And there is a misperception out there. I think a lot of people believe we're paid congressional salaries, among other things. I believe that this is a good opportunity to help educate our voters that, in fact, people are making just over $31,000 a year, and they have for the last 10 years. I think they'd be surprised to find that. But it's hard when you're put in the standpoint of putting yourself forward as a public servant and then being told you're also supposed to figure out your own pay. And this removes that. And as Senator Olson, as you were saying, you know, the compensation councils work pretty well, except for we don't follow it.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I just heard there was a former senator that I thought heard it very well, and she said compensation for the legislature should never be so high. It's why you run or why you stay. It should never be so low you can't serve. So I think that's really putting it. And I think for so many people, it is on the low end.
depends on how you can work things out and if your family's grown up and this type of thing. But I have, you know, I've talked to certain people that are very interested in government and so on over the years, and I will occasionally ask them if they would consider running for the legislature someday. Number one thing is I can't stand the, I couldn't take the $20,000 cut in pay or the $30,000 cut in pay. So I think it is too much on the low side. Now, I'm a little concerned about what authority we give them. I was on the Compensation Council before, and there was a recommendation that I thought was pretty good, and that's where it ended. Now, at one time, we had it so that the Compensation Council's recommendation was automatic.
Unless the legislature said no.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then it got to the point where when we would fund it, then there was there's always some demagogues among us, you know, that somehow probably don't need the money and they think nobody else should have it either. And so it hasn't worked very well, but I think we, didn't we do that one time or something? Didn't it take effect? But it got scuttled.
I think we had the authority to reverse it, and it kept doing that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because it was an election year.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let's go.
Well, but I guess I know just exactly what does this include?
Salaries.
Does it include?
Salaries.
Does it include?
Salaries. That's it.
Property.
No, they would take into consideration, as you know from when you were doing this before, broadly what else is in play and take a look at that. But it would be the base salaries.
I think it's a good idea.
And Mr. Chair, members, very quickly, I certainly agree with Senator Metz, and I know that most people here have another event to be attending. But you should know that in California, the Compensation Council has been looking at perhaps suggesting lowering pay. So there is potentially a minor risk there. But that you should also know that the governor is the only one that appoints there. And I think the legislature and the governor have been having a little bit of a disagreement on a few things. There's a good balance here. It's worked well. All of the appointing entities have taken their job seriously.
Automobiles.
No automobiles, no.
No limousine for the
No program. Limousines, no nothing.
Some states have cars.
Okay, I take it this does not include either merit pay or performance?
There is no merit pay or pay for performance, Mr. Chair. Those are called elections.
So we have, as I recall, we did adopt the A19. So Senator Clark moves that Senate File 3793 as amended to recommend the pass.
Aye.
Anybody want to testify?